You want to be finding Isaiah chapter 9 in the Bibles that are scattered around. And that happens to be page 693. And I thought I'd tell you an interesting story that I heard just this week. Pause to blow nose. So yeah, this story came in, and it's about a Syrian woman, a Muslim Syrian woman, who is a refugee from the conflict that's going on in Syria. And there's a relief team. She was in a Lebanese Muslim village near the Syrian border. And there's a relief team, Christian relief team, taking food and just trying to help various people. And this particular person was met. But apparently Jesus had been there first. When the Christians knocked at her door, the widow appeared fully covered in black. She was a widow because her husband had been murdered a short time earlier. So she was covered in black, including an opaque veil over her face. She explained her period of self-isolation, which is a full 40 days of self, just removing yourself from society in mourning as a widow. They offered to leave the food outside, but she unexpectedly invited them in. They sat with her and her children on the floor of the temporary dwelling. "Who are you?" she asked anxiously. And they replied, "You don't know us, but we have great love in our hearts towards you," the team leader answered, explaining their reasons for helping Syrian refugees. "That love comes from God who's worked in our lives." To their amazement, she responded by removing her veil, unheard of in her conservative Muslim country culture. Then the words came flooding out. "I want to tell you what happened to me yesterday," she said, her voice trembling with emotion. "As I was sleeping during the night, someone knocked on my door. I was so scared, but I opened the window to see who it was, but no one was there. After a while, I heard the same knocking. My heart was beating so fast, so I went and sat beside the door, and I fell asleep there. As I was sleeping, someone put his hand on my shoulder. He said, 'You don't know me. You passed through a great pain. I experienced a great pain also. But I will not leave you alone. Tomorrow, I will send you someone who will tell you about me. Listen to him.'" When she finished the story, she began to weep. She turned to the team leader and said, "Tell me about this person I saw in my dream." Isn't that incredible? That, I am told, is a common experience of a lot of Muslim people, that are dreams, their experiences, and Jesus appears to them, and they're led to Christ. That begins a process of them coming to Christ. And that happens so often, it's almost predictable. So, very encouraging story, the fact that Jesus Christ is at work in all cultures, and there's no ultimate barrier to the rule of Jesus Christ. So what's been in the news this week? I was just in my mind kind of running over the news this week. There's been some horrific things that have been happening. There's the shooting of the kids in the school in the States. 20 children senselessly murdered. There was a survey that indicated that the number of Christians in the UK has dropped by, I've forgotten the figure actually, but by a significant amount, but there's been a drop. There's the issue of the legalization of gay marriage, which is rumbling on. There's Parliament, so that's going to come before Parliament. Some are beginning to say there's a kind of moral problem in our country. We're trying to fix the economy, sort out finances, sort out trade and so on, but we're missing the whole issue of our morality. And we're getting further and further into debt, there's delinquency, there's drugs, there's all sorts of abuse and so on. And we're not fixing the problems in our society. It's not getting any better. And then you go international, there's what's going on in Egypt, which is possibly a more repressive constitution or allowing repression in Egypt, which looks like it's being passed. There's what's going on in Iraq. I read something this week, an absolutely horrific murder of Christians in a church in Iraq. And then there's the Syrian thing. People are just getting killed, slaughtered every day. It's not a pretty world that we live in, actually. We have, thankfully, places of peace and places of tranquility and places where there's warmth, but it's not a pretty world when we look at it overall. Well, I want to look at, that's the news here and now, but what about the news in Isaiah chapter 9? I thought, as you're all so good at giving attention when I speak, I thought instead of simply speaking about this passage in Isaiah chapter 9, I thought I'd speak about the first 9 chapters. Is that okay? We're just going to run through all 9 chapters. What was going on here? And we'll get on to Isaiah 9. Isaiah 9, if you want to get the sneak preview, is a fantastic prophecy about the coming of Christ. And it happened 7 / 8 centuries before Christ was born. So this guy, Isaiah, he was seeing into the far distance the entrance of Jesus Christ into the world. He was prophesying things that Jesus would do. But what was the context? What was the news in Isaiah? What was going on in their society? So Isaiah chapter 1, back a few pages. I'm going to do this at breakneck speed. But Isaiah 1, and if I'd been really well prepared, I'd have had all sorts of visuals on the screen, but I haven't, so you're just going to have to listen and pay attention. But here, Isaiah begins. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 2, he says, "Hear, O heavens, listen, O earth, for the Lord's spoken. I reared children, brought them up, but they've rebelled against me." God saying to the people of Israel, as well as others, said, "I brought you into existence, but you've rebelled against me." Verse 21 of chapter 1, he says that the faithful city, which is supposed to be Jerusalem, says, "See how the faithful city has become a harlot. She once was full of justice. Righteousness used to dwell in her, but now murderers." Chapter 2, verse 6, speaks about superstitions. He says, "You have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob. They're full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and clasp hands with pagans." The people that were supposed to be worshipping the true God have ended up just kind of buying into their whole culture, into their whole life. All sorts of wild superstitions that seem to have emanated from the east. Chapter 3, verse 1, there was going to be some difficulty come. "See now, the Lord Almighty, is about to take from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, all supplies of food and all supplies of water. The hero and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the soothsayer and the elder, captain of 50 men and of rank, the counselor, skilled craftsman and clever enchanter. I'll make boys their officials, mere children who'll govern them." So he's saying, look, things are going to get bad. There's going to be a shortage of food, shortage of water, and there's going to be a shortage of leadership. It's just going to be incompetents who end up leading the nation. And verse 13 of chapter 3, what else was going on? I mean, the newspapers at the time would have just been grim reading, as they are today for us. Verse 13 of chapter 3, he says, verse 15 of chapter 3, he says, "What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor?" So the poor were being oppressed. It's the poor that were being oppressed. The poor were suffering horribly. The women, verse 16 of chapter 3, the Lord says, "The women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, flirting with their eyes, tripping along with mincing steps, with ornaments jingling on their ankles." So the women were haughty and flirtatious. You just get the impression that this was a city and a nation that stank, as it were. It was just not in a good place. Chapter 5, verse 11, another facet of what was going on. "Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they're inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord." So they were drinking and entertaining themselves into oblivion, really. It was going to become, and you kind of see this as a kind of theme running through this, that it was going to become a desolation and a wasteland, and it was going to be trampled. So that was life 700 or more years before Christ was born in Jerusalem and in Judah. There were flashes of hope in what Isaiah goes on to say. So that was it morally and socially. What about it politically? This is I find really interesting, actually, and I hope it won't kind of bore you, but there was, I should really have done a visual for this, but there was Judah and there was Israel. There were 12 tribes originally, and the 10 tribes became Israel, and they were in the north, and Judah, the two tribes, were in the south. And this is being addressed to Judah. And the king of Judah was a chap called Ahaz. Bad King Ahaz. You can boo and you can hiss whenever you hear Ahaz's name. Boo, hiss. So he was a bad lot, and he features in this. But he was the king of Judah, the two tribes. And Israel, the 10 northern tribes, had another king, and they were in a worse state still. And then there was Syria over to the east a little bit. Now, Israel and Syria were actually quaking in their boots because the new superpower was actually Assyria, further over to the east. And that was going to be a dominant world force for some considerable time. And they were expansionist, and they were after territory and power. So little Israel and little Syria had formed an alliance, and they wanted little Judah to join them. Are you with me on this? So they wanted this three-way alliance against the new superpower, Assyria. But Israel wasn't too keen about it. In fact, and that's where we pick this up, the whole thing in Isaiah 9. That's where we pick this up in terms of Ahaz meeting Isaiah and what's going on there. Ahaz is basically quaking in his boots because Syria and Israel have invaded the land. I was wondering if I could do this in a kind of contemporary way. And I have to say, this is a total illustration. I'm not trying to make any political point at all. No doubt people will speak with me afterwards. But just try and make it fit our context. Let's suppose it's Scotland. Let's suppose, instead of Judah, read Scotland. And instead of Israel and Syria, read England and Wales. Boo, hiss. And the new superpower is Europe. Well, maybe. Or is it China? I'm not quite sure, actually. But let's suppose it's Europe. So England and Wales really want Scotland to be part of the whole alliance against Europe. Okay? They really do not want European influence. Have we heard that before somewhere? And so England and Wales are really ticked off with Scottish independence. And that's very contemporary, isn't it? They're really ticked off with Scottish independence. And so they invade, and they invade Berwick-on-Tweed again, and that becomes part of England. And they move into the borders and take some of the border towns and so on. And Alex Salmond, or at least King Ahaz in this particular image, is strutting around on the walls of Edinburgh Castle, terrified about this invasion from the south of the allied armies of England and Wales. Saying to join us against Europe. So you get the feeling. Maybe identify with that a little bit. So that's what's going on. That is what the equivalent of what is happening here. Long introduction. But let's now read this, because Isaiah's message to him, to King Ahaz, strutting around on the castle walls, is stay calm. Stay calm. Don't go into crazy alliances. And the sneak preview is that what the bad king Ahaz does is he doesn't go into this alliance with Israel and Syria. He actually makes an alliance with the superpower. And he relies on the superpower to come and smash these other two. And it wasn't a good idea. It was not a good idea. So let's read this. Chapter 9, verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. And in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoiced at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born. To us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. And if to underline, as if to underline it, he says, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. What bad King Ahaz ended up doing was making a crazy alliance with the new superpower, and that was an implied rejection of God. And that is what this is about, and that's a choice for us as to whether we rely on things that actually ultimately are going to crumble, or whether we're going to choose to live our lives in dependence and reliance upon God. It's the promise of a child. The promise of a child is so interesting. One of the things which you sang this morning was, how did God enter the world? Was it with armies, and was it with a huge plan to take over the world? Well, yeah, he was going to take over the world. He is going to take over the world. But actually, how did he enter into human history? He entered in as a little baby. A little baby. And as I delight to say, Jesus is still, he is no longer a little baby. He has grown up, and he is the Lord of all that there is. And as I said last week, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but on Christmas Day, Jesus, the baby, is not going to come. He has already come, he's already done his work, and he's actually already reigning in eternity. And his kingdom is growing and expanding, just as we saw with that Syrian woman, that Syrian refugee, touching people's lives. And his kingdom is rolling down the generations and the centuries, touching people, transforming situations. There are, it's estimated, 2.1 billion Christians in the world. Now, I know that's kind of a very broad figure of all sorts of people that may or may not be Christians, but 2.1 billion people have got some allegiance to Jesus Christ. And if you like the competitiveness of it, that's more than any other religion. But it's not an issue of competitiveness. But the point is that Jesus Christ, he entered as a child, and yet now he is reigning as a king, and his kingdom is extending and growing. But look at some of the phrases in this. Let me just pick my way through this. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. Just love that phrase. My wife, Claire, when she became a Christian, that was a phrase which she'd heard, and it just spoke volumes into her life. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. I wonder if some of you remember me reading that email I got from somebody who'd become a Christian recently. And it's called Jenna, and she had just seen the Try Praying logo on a church, and she'd gone in, she got hold of a booklet, started praying. She had a terrible situation. She'd lost a child through an ectopic pregnancy. And she started praying, and something transformed in her life. And she said, it was like a light going on. That was her phrase. She probably hadn't been reading this kind of stuff, but it said it was like a light going on in her life. And that's what becoming a Christian is like. It's like a light going on. You know, that's what it's about. I remember when I became a Christian years ago, it's kind of like, this makes sense of life. You know, life is not the kind of cynical, depressing thing that I'd known before. It's kind of like, this makes sense of life. It's life now and life in eternity. A light is going on. So the people walking in darkness have seen a great light, and it's shining on those living in the land of the shadow of death. A light has dawned. Now that phrase, shadow of death, again, that's so descriptive of you know, what life is like for people. You just, you know, you're stuck in this world, in this body, with this, you know, for many people, it's a kind of miserable experience. And you know at the end of it is death. And it sounds like, oh, you know, is that what life is about? Is that what it's all about? And people are just living in the shadow of death. And there is gloom, and there's despondency, and there's discouragement, and all sorts of bad stuff. That can be a description of life on earth, people living in the shadow of death. And this is saying a light has dawned. It's saying something has come into the world, and a light has dawned. I wonder, Derek, if you could put that image up again we've seen before, and I don't make any apology for showing this again. It's the image of the open door. It'll come up in a moment. I told the story of how I first discovered this the other week, but it was this was a picture of a church in France. And, all right. Well, it's not working. Well, if you find the image of the door, stick it on. But if you don't worry about it. Don't put anything funny on, because I won't be able to see it, and they'll all be laughing, and I wonder what's going on. Okay, it's a picture of an open door and light, you know, flooding in. Some of you have seen that the other week. And it's just a fantastic image of something, you know, warm, light, beautiful, coming into a place of dank and darkness. And that's what it's like. That's what Christ has done. He's brought light into a place of darkness. Those living in the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Oh, well found. Great. It was the day before when I woke up singing. Just to very briefly tell the story, I never wake up singing. But I woke up singing this line from a song, which was "See Heaven's Open Door." And I said to my daughter, Catherine, I said, "What is this song?" And she didn't know what it was. I did a search of songs beginning with "See Heaven's Open Door." Couldn't be found anywhere. And it turned out I was singing a new line to an existing song. I was singing the wrong words, basically. And we ended up constructing a whole verse around this. It's a lovely song, "There is a Higher Throne." But we ended up with a whole new verse of this, and this is it, "See Heaven's Open Door." It was this day, visited this church, and I saw this picture, and I thought, yes, that's what it's like. It's just an image of light coming into a dark place. So, light in a dark place. Let me move on quickly here. Verse 4, "As in the days of Midian's defeat, you shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor." Midian's defeat, that was Gideon and his merry band of 300 who whopped tens of thousands of Midianites. And it was just the shattering of an oppressive people. And they'd been oppressing them with all manner of things. And again, this is what Jesus does. He comes, as in the day of Midian's defeat, you shatter the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders. I just wonder if you feel in some way in your life burdened. I wonder if you feel like there's something which is just kind of hanging over you, oppressing you, some kind of depression, some mood that just affects every way you turn in your day or in your week. Well, what Jesus does is he shatters that, he breaks that, he brings hope to those situations. So, and then moving on, but verse 6, here it is. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. His kingdom is growing, but it's not yet here." There's still all sorts of horrible things that happen, but God's kingdom is growing. "But for us a son is given, a child is born." This is for us. I was thinking about this and just trying to illustrate it, and I can't really. But I felt it's a little bit like if you imagine yourself playing in some team game and you're getting beat, and you're all a bit weary, and it's just not going your way. And then there's a substitute made, and you know the player that comes on your side is actually the player that can make all the difference. And all of a sudden, kind of hope rises, and you're and all of a sudden, instead of being on the back foot, you're on the front foot, and you're beginning to win. And there's a bit of sense of victory that's coming into your effort. And I think it's a bit like that. Our son, to us, a son is given. This one is given. Any of you read or seen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Read the books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or seen the film, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the character Aslan. And Aslan is an image of Christ in the whole story there. And one of the phrases, it's so great, it's just that Aslan's on the move. Aslan's on the move. And it's like that. It's like Jesus is on the move. Jesus is on the move, and he's doing stuff, and he's changing situations. And there's a sense of victory, the sense of that, you know, that the wicked witch is actually on the way out. The wicked witch is defeated, and Aslan's on the move, and life is coming, and light is coming to people. Look at those phrases in verse 6. The government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. I don't know. How do you think of Jesus? when you're alone, if you pray, you know, how do you think of Jesus? Is he some kind of, you with the best will in the world, some kind of construction in your imagination of a kind of nice, benevolent person, as it were, who will listen to you if you pray? That's fine. But how do you think of Jesus? What is it actually like? And I realize that I cannot get a thought big enough to describe Jesus. I cannot get the image in my head of what he is really like. It's kind of like he's just cosmic. He is ultimate reality. And he's not some little imagination in my head. He's not some little God that I keep in my pocket and pull out privately, as it were. He's ultimate reality. And we can never get away from him. We can never avoid him. And the whole idea of trusting Jesus Christ with our lives is the most sensible thing we can do with our lives. So bad King Ahaz missed the point. He was being told that this child who was to come, and there was actually a child born who would be called Emmanuel at that time, but actually Isaiah was talking about the future, and he missed the point that God, this eternal, awesome, creative, infinite God, was actually willing to come and work alongside bad King Ahaz. And Ahaz missed the point, and he made this stupid alliance with Assyria. He missed the point. But for us, we don't miss the point. We don't need to move into trusting things that are ultimately going to crumble. We don't need to do that. We can trust the one who is ultimate reality. Do you need somebody who is wonderful? Actually, wonderful there, it can actually mean supernatural. So do you need in your life somebody who will do supernatural stuff? Do you need counsel? You get in a situation, you don't have a clue, you know, I don't know what to do here. Do you need a counselor? Well, Christ is there. Do you need God in your life, mighty God in your life? The fatherhood, the everlasting father. I was thinking about that today, and I'm beginning to get on a bit, and I am a father, and I'm thinking, well, as I get older and older, I will be less able to be a good father in terms of faculty and ability and so on. And my sons and daughters will, you know, they'll rise, they're competent anyway. But the whole idea of an everlasting father, a father who's not going to grow old, a father who will always be there for us, a father who is wise and loving and caring. Do you need an everlasting father? and a Prince of Peace. Do you need peace in your life? You've got those kind of anxieties and stresses and worries. Do you need, just right in the kind of center of your being, do you need peace? Well, that's all here in Jesus. Aslan is on the move. Jesus is on the move. He is awesome. So for Ahaz, it was a choice between quiet faith or desperate alliances. And for us, it's the same choice. Quiet faith in an awesome, ultimate reality. Quiet faith in him, or making desperate alliances with things that will crumble. So where do we go with this? I want to just emphasize two words in this as we finish. Verse 6, it says, "For to us," it occurs twice, "to us a child is born, to us a son is given." It's to us. That includes you and I, includes everybody in this room. It's to us. It wasn't just for them then, but this is for us now. Christ is given for us. That means that it's kind of like we belong to him. We're part of his family. He's accessible. He is present with us. That Christ is given for us. So there's the door. And this side of the door, there's life as it's being meted out to us. Good bits, bad bits, depressing bits, exciting bits, as it were. But a son has been born for us, and a light has dawned. And I want you to just kind of picture yourself standing on the steps. You can't go through the door yet because it's only death that will get you through there. Got to wait for that one, I'm afraid. But you're standing on the steps, and you can stand in the light and experience just something of the love and the presence of Christ in your life. Just picture yourself there. In a moment, we're going to sing a song about the faithfulness of God. And there's our choice, whether to trust things that are going to crumble or to trust God. But I want you to picture yourself there. And I want to give you something you can actually do if it helps you. It doesn't need to, but I've got a pile of nice shiny stones here. And you can, I just want to invite you, as we sing this last song, that you can come to the front and you can pick up a stone, just as a symbol of you saying, okay, I'm going to trust God in my life. I'm not going to make desperate alliances. I'm not going to trust the wrong things. But I just want, for today, for this week, I'm choosing to trust God. You remember when David walloped Goliath? He chose 5 smooth stones, and he only needed one of them, actually. Well, I've got the other 4 here. I haven't. But he just chose a smooth stone, and just have it as a symbol of victory. You know, he sorted out the giant in his life. And for you, as you trust Christ, you know, what's the giant in your life? What's the thing that oppresses you? What's the rod of the oppressor in your life? What's the thing that discourages you? What's the thing that burdens you in your life? Well, come and choose a stone. You can take 5 if you want. Come and choose a stone and just have that as a symbol of you saying, okay, I'm going to trust God. God is awesome. He's a wonderful counselor. He's a mighty God, an everlasting Father. I'm going to trust God with my life now, and I'm going to trust that he's going to lead me in victory in the way that he wants, and I'm not going to trust the wrong things. So there you are. You can come and get a stone as we sing this last song. And to sing the last song, we need musicians.